Welcome to The Sound of Economics. I'm Antonia Parat. I'm pleased to bring you this podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based think tank specialized in economics and economic policy. Each episode of the podcast explores one of Europe's big policy debates and looks at the work Bruegel scholars have done on the topic. This episode focuses on the banking system in Europe and some of the challenges it is facing. The financial crisis made it clear that more should be done to create conditions for a safer financial system. The EU has taken measures to do that, and one of them is the creation of the banking union. The policy vision behind the banking union was defined as breaking the vicious circle between banks and sovereigns, which implies bringing all instruments of the banking sector policy to the Eurozone level. How much has been done so far to complete the banking union? We asked Nicolas Veron, senior fellow at Bruegel.
So it's an incomplete banking union, but it's also very substantial. We have a centralization of banking supervision for all banks in the Eurozone, directly at the ECB for the larger ones, and with supervisory oversight by the ECB of the national authorities for smaller banks. This has been in place for more than 2 years now. And more recently, a year ago, a resolution framework was introduced through the Bank Recovery and Resolution Directive, and especially the creation of the Single Resolution Board in Brussels. But this new framework remains largely untested. Even so, we have a first case of precautionary recapitalization under BRRD with Monte dei Paschi di Siena, which is still ongoing, but there has been no resolution per se decided under the new framework, either at the national or at the European level through the Single Resolution Board.
And how successful has the implementation of the banking union been so far?
My broad assessment is that the reform is successful. The new supervisory framework centered on the ECB is more rigorous, more demanding, and more fair than the framework it replaced. So than the fragmented framework of national supervision that was replaced by this new European banking supervision. So national supervision was generally less demanding, less rigorous than what is now being done by the ECB, and it was also very heterogeneous, very different from one country to another. Now we may not have reached complete equal treatment yet, because the transition is extremely complicated, but there is a broader sense of fairness and also, crucially, a better ability to compare supervisory practices from one country to another than was the case before. So I think there is no question that this reform has introduced a significant improvement in the quality and fairness and sustainability of banking supervision in the Eurozone. That doesn't mean it's enough. And supervision, I think, still has some way to go to fulfill its promise of a sound and safe banking system, which means that the ECB in some cases has been slow. Italy, obviously, is the best example. They correctly diagnosed significant problems in the Italian banking system through the comprehensive assessment that was done in 2014, results published in October 2014. So at that time, it was clear that the Italian banking system needed broad-based restructuring and policy action, and very little has happened for a number of reasons in the ensuing 2 years. So the ECB has now taken very forceful action in the case of Monte dei Paschi di Siena, and that will have systemic implications for Italy, and I think that's very good. But it came quite late in the sequence compared to what would have been done ideally. Now, in fairness to the ECB, I think given all the things they had to do in terms of putting in place a new framework and also dealing with the Greek crisis in 2015, I think they have, in a way, good excuses for not having intervened in Italy forcefully in 2015. There was also, sadly, no consensus with the national authorities, the Bank of Italy, at that time. And in 2016, there was a referendum campaign initiated by Prime Minister Renzi, which made it essentially impossible in practice for the ECB to be proactive, because it would have been seen, perhaps unfairly, but inevitably, as political interference. And therefore, it was a bit of an unfortunate sequence that introduced this 2-year delay. But I think the good news is that better late than never, the ECB is now taking action, which to me appears broadly appropriate to deal with the legacy of banking fragility in Italy.
So it seems that Italy is the first big test of how the banking union framework will function in practice. We asked Silvia Merler, affiliate fellow at Bruegel, to share her assessment of the situation in Italy and to explain which steps have been taken to address the issues.
Well, there has been a number of initiatives that have been taken by the government so far. The problem with that is that all this kind of thing takes time to show results, first of all. So one thing that has been done is the public guarantee on low-performing loans proposal, which was approved last year, but still doesn't really seem to be producing much of a result. But I guess it's one of the things that takes time. At the same time, the government implemented a reform that sort of pushed toward concentration in the banking sector, which is a good thing for the Italian banking sector, because Italy is one of the countries where banks have a lot of branches, and this increases significantly their operating costs, which means their profit margins also are low, and this is a further structural factor of weakness. So there has been a number of initiatives that are positive and go in the right direction. But I think the fact that now we have this political issue will possibly delay further action on the banking sector.
Will these issues in the Italian banking sector negatively reflect on the progress towards completing the banking union?
I don't think so, because for two reasons, in fact. One is that Italy is a case where banking problems have been known for a while, and at least in my opinion, they could have been dealt with earlier, but they have not. So the problem sort of dragged on and was dealt with when it was really impossible to avoid it, and therefore the conditions were different from those under which other countries dealt with their banking issues before. And at the same time, I think the case that we have seen last year and this year proves that the ECB is really willing to be tough when it comes to exercising the new role as a supervisor. So I don't think that will reflect that on the implementation of banking union, particularly when it comes to supervision.
One of the key aspects of the banking union is the creation of the European Deposit Insurance Scheme, which has proven to be the most challenging part of completing the banking union. We asked Bruegel's senior fellow Dirk Schoenmaker why this is such an important piece of the puzzle.
We are now doing supervision from an integrated view. That also means then that we have to do crisis management from an integrated view. And that means European deposit insurance. And people are, of course, quite reluctant to that, because that feels like a bit of burden sharing. But I think once we clean up the non-performing loans, and we have properly capitalized banks across the euro area, then we should also do the European deposit insurance, because otherwise you cannot have integrated banks and integrated supervision. Well, if it goes wrong, you leave it to the countries to pay up. So once we get the legacy behind us, then it is high time that we do European deposit insurance. And let's not forget, if we look at the last 10 years, not only banks in Italy or Portugal can fail, also in the Netherlands and Germany banks can fail. So in that sense, European deposit insurance is really equivalent of supervision by the European Central Bank. At the moment, there is no political will to do it, especially not from the north, like Finland, Germany and the Netherlands, Austria. So I think if we clean up the non-performing loans and we make sure the banks are well capitalized across the euro area, then we have to start to discuss it again, because we need to prepare for the future.
So what will the future bring? One of the key questions is how Brexit will affect future developments in the banking sector, considering the fact that London is a major financial center. We asked Dirk to offer his assessment.
So, with Brexit, it means that if we do business with clients in the EU27, investment banking activities, wholesale market activities, that's no longer possible from London. We need to do it from somewhere else in the EU27 because a financial firm needs a passport. We call it a MiFID passport, Markets in Financial Instruments Directive. And it means that there are certain rules for if you are giving advice or selling products to corporates or households, you have to follow these rules. So this business will move from London to the EU27. And we estimate that it's about 1/3 of the current wholesale market in London. So that means that a sizable part of these large US investment banks, the Swiss investment banks, so 1/3 of the London business moves to the continent. Also the Euro area banks like BNP Paribas and Deutsche Bank will offer these wholesale products to clients. And then again, we really need to supervise them in an integrated way. So it should not make a difference whether you are in Milan, Frankfurt or Brussels or Paris. So we should supervise them in an integrated way. And again, that means that the ECB is doing the job in an overall view. And then also the crisis management for these banks, if it goes wrong, like lender of last resort, should also then be done at the euro area level. And in that way, Brexit is an opportunity to build our wholesale markets in Europe. But it also means that the European Central Bank and the European Securities and Markets Authority, the security supervisor, should operate from a European level, looking at these new wholesale markets. For the UK, they will lose a sizable part of the business, some 30%. But at the same time, 70% will stay. So we should not be too pessimistic. So 70% will stay. And you could also say that the financial sector has been growing too large in the UK. So becoming slightly smaller, that also gives opportunities to other services and industry and manufacturers to grow a bit more in the mix, in the business mix of the UK. So in that sense, London will stay an international financial hub with the 70%, so that's beyond doubt. And they have a bit of business migrating away, but it gives an opportunity to build their services and manufacturing sector.
So it seems that Brexit brings certain risks but also offers opportunities. Despite that, Nicolas explains why he considers Brexit a lose-lose proposition.
I'm not too concerned about the impact of Brexit for financial stability because I believe the financial system is very adaptable and it will have, in that case, sufficient time to adapt and anticipate in order to avert disruptive outcomes. That doesn't mean it is a happy story, of course, and I, for one, certainly view Brexit, as many people do on the continent, maybe if you are in the UK, I don't know, as a lose-lose proposition. It's a development in which the UK will lose a lot, but the EU27 will lose as well. The EU will lose politically because it loses a big member, and that's evidently a loss of substance, and also economically because it is a negative sum game economically when you introduce barriers within a bloc that was fairly integrated through a consistent framework of laws, a single market, with this separation between the UK and the EU27. So it goes against free trade, it goes against the cross-border economic integration, and we will all get poorer from it, or almost all. There will be a few winners, of course, and in particular, there is some financial activities that will migrate from London to the rest of to the EU27, and that will be good for some places or some firms. But generally speaking, this is a collective loss for EU28, for the UK, and I believe for EU27 as well. So nothing to rejoice about, even if you agree with me that disruptive financial instability can and will very probably be avoided.
So Brexit will be one of the challenges ahead for the European banking system, but there are also other challenges to address in the longer run. Dirk identifies overbanking as one of those challenges.
The medium-term challenge is that we have too much banking capacity. We call that overbanking. So there will be either merchant acquisitions or there will be other exits from the market. And to do that in an orderly manner, we need proper mechanisms, including deposit insurance for a failing bank to pay off the depositors, so that we have good capacity at the supervisory and at the crisis management level to guide this transition to a smaller banking system. And we see it already happening because if you read the newspapers, in every country, people at banks are fired. And that's just due to overbanking, also technology. The internet and IT is taking over the administrative jobs. And that's here to stay, that banks are downsizing. And the ones who don't do that, they will lose out competitively. So the downsizing in employment of the banking system is happening across Europe, across the world. And we need an orderly mechanism to guide that process.
And that brings us to the end of this podcast. Thanks for listening to The Sound of Economics. If you are interested in more Bruegel work on European banking, there's a range of blogs and papers by our scholars available on our website at www.bruegel.org. I hope you'll join us again for The Sound of Economics. See you next time.